We are coming to the lecture of this evening, and we are very glad to have Ursula Hughes with us, who is from London. And to introduce her, I'll simply read out some sentences from her website and then say why we did invite her, because I think the website is really working fine. So she is the professor of international labor studies at the Working Lives Research Institute at the London Metropolitan University. And before that, she worked a couple of years at the University of North London and lectured widely throughout Europe and Canada, the United States, Australia, India, and Malaysia. I'll mention just one more activity. She is the editor of the International Interdisciplinary Peer-Reviewed Journal, Work Organization, Labor and Globalization, and the kind of a short title of it is Cybertariat, which is also the net address of that journal. And Cybertariat is really one of the points why we wanted to, Ursula Hughes to speak at our class conference, because I think she has very interesting things to say about the dynamics of class today and about the reorganization of the global working class in a knowledge economy. This is part of what Cybertariat stands for. A few of her texts are widely known and have been translated, for example, into German. One appeared in the issue in the review Das Argument, and I remember that I at least partly helped translating it. So we, yes, and Alexander Gallus, who is sitting here, did the main part of the translation. So this is kind of a family reunion, and we did also read other texts of hers, which appeared at the beginning of the 2000s. One which impressed me very much, or which I quote very much like to quote, is one where she talks about a reserve army of knowledge workers, which is being made just now, and partly by the new European university or higher education politics. So this is what I always like to quote when I quote Ursula Hughes, and maybe I think one could even speak of it in a shorter formula. I don't know if it works in English, it works in German. You could also talk of the intellectual reserve army, as opposed to the industrial reserve army. So those are parts of what Ursula Hughes is doing research about, and we are very interested in what she is going to say about proletariat, precariat, and cubertariat. And there was the demand that Ursula Hughes should speak slowly so that everyone can follow. And she says that part of that will be taken over by the PowerPoint presentation, so you can't really follow the keywords, and I hope the rest will also put in a way that we all can understand it. Yes, and we are very interested what is going to follow.
Well, thank you very much for that flattering introduction. What have I done? I've just switched everything off. My relationship with technology summed up in one gesture. Anyway, I want to start really with... oh, we're going to have to log back in again. Sorry about that. With one big apology, which is the fact that I... which is that I'm addressing you in this horrible global language of English, the language of Bill Gates and Microsoft and so on. If I tell you it's not my native language, maybe you'll feel a little bit better, have more of a kindred spirit with me. I think I explained that my native language is Welsh, and if I addressed you in Welsh, I don't think anybody in this room would understand a word, then maybe you will forgive me the English. The other problem I have is I have a health problem right now, which is I don't have enough hemoglobin, so the oxygen supply to my brain is rather intermittent, and occasionally I just forget things, and you'll have to forget. I think there are an awful lot of unaddressed issues that we have to somehow come to terms with if we're going to develop any serious class analysis that in this, you know, horrifying conjuncture we find ourselves in globally, if we're going to find a way forward, find which groups of workers are in a position to make alliances with which other groups of workers, and to take forward some sort of resistance to global capitalism in its present form. It seems to me there are some huge problems that we have to address. Firstly, of course, this is a truism, I guess, for this kind of an audience, we have to distinguish between problems in terms of actually determining what somebody's objective class position is, if you like, what in what relation does the work of a particular worker stand in relation to capital, and the very different subjective perception of class position or consciousness or whatever you want to call it. And it seems to me there are two different sets of problems associated with these two different dimensions of class. Each is problematic, each is contested, each is, I would argue, profoundly contradictory right now. What I'm going to do in this presentation, or try to do, is firstly to just summarise some of the main theoretical and empirical problems that we're faced with if we want to do any kind of serious research or analysis. I want to focus particularly on what you might call white-collar work or office work or information processing work, and the very fact that we don't have a name for it represents part of what the problem is. We now have in most developed countries at least 35% of the workforce, in many more than that, up to 60% in some countries of the workforce, basically doing forms of work that involve the processing of information in some way or other. And these workers have not really been addressed historically in the literature. Sociological literature on class has ignored these workers, by and large, since the Second World War. There were a few famous studies, and interestingly enough, these studies describe these workers in relation to the way men who did those jobs dressed. There were two famous books, The Black-Coated Worker and The White-Collar Worker, which were the two kind of main texts on office work from the 1950s onwards. And it seems to me that part of the problem was that people were thinking about class in relation to households. The worker was presumed to be a man. The members of the male of the household were presumed to take their class status from the head of the household, the father or the husband or whoever. And so class was analysed basically in terms of households, and a lot of the basic demographic statistics that were used by sociologists were actually based on households and not individuals. Of course, people entered the workforce as individuals, not as members of households, but the individual worker has an individual relation with the employer. And the huge, enormous expansion of white-collar work that took place from the 1950s to the 1990s was largely made up of women workers, very many of them married women workers, who were perceived not to matter and not to be real workers by our comrades on the left quite as much as by the sociologists, because they were sitting inside these households where the class status of which was presumed to derive from the position of the father or the husband. And if you looked objectively, there was a study done in, I think, in 1986, which showed that actually less than 30% of households in the UK did the husband and the male and the cohabiting male and female, did they have the same class status? A lot of these women office workers who, if they were thought of at all, was thought of as some kind of part of the petty bourgeoisie or something like that, these office workers, were married to guys who worked in factories or worked on building sites or drove trucks. So their class status was actually rendered completely invisible. And I think this problem subjective experiences of class, and look to see whether there's any evidence of new forms of class consciousness emerging among these workers. So, going back to the first point about how on earth do you determine somebody's objective class position, there actually is no agreement about how to do this empirically. You can look at people's functional relation to capital, the functional relation of the labour to capital. You can look at the occupation, which is the occupation is differently defined, it's confusingly defined in different contexts, but generally speaking, that defines the place of the technical division of labour. You can look at the social relation to production, the relationship to the ownership of capital, like whether somebody owns the means of production or not, which is the traditional way of looking at it, I guess. You can look at the place in the social division of labour, including the gender division of labour in the household, which is something different from the technical division of labour, the social division of labour. It includes unpaid work, and it includes forms of power relation, which are not necessarily the relation of capital to labour. And you can look at social status, in the classic Weber sense, but also in a number of other ways that are currently fashionable. It seems to me there's an extraordinary fashion in sociology to look ethnographically at class, to look at workers in a kind of descriptive and often rather sentimentalised kind of way, as cultures, look at working class life as a culture in the same way that an Aboriginal tribe or something would have a culture, and to rather sentimentalise it in the way that Richard Sennett does, or indeed in the way a lot of former Maoists do in the United States, people like Mike Zweig. But basically to think that in describing these dying industrialistic cultures, we are somehow doing something to contribute to the development of socialism seems to me extraordinary. But there we are. There's a big fashion for looking at class in these kind of descriptive ways. And because there are very serious issues to do with different status groups, ethnicity, and so on. And then there are big questions about how you look at people's class positions. Do you look at it within the context of a single national, a single state, a single country, or do you look at it internationally? Because you get some very strange contradictions if you start comparing the position of people doing exactly the same job in, say, in India and in the United States. I mean, you've got the same labour process, the same work process, people working for the same employer, using the same languages, using the same software. And in the United States, these are desperate, precarious, part-time, poorly educated workers working part-time without proper employment contracts and so on. In India, they're part of the elite. They're people with postgraduate degrees who employ several servants, whose position in the local class hierarchy is totally different, but who nevertheless are doing exactly the same work, the same employers, with the same labour process. So you've got a lot of problems when you start trying to look internationally. And then I've already touched on this question, then you have this question, do you look at the household, do you look at the individual, how do you actually sort of formulate your approach to class? I'm going to go through these first 5 points in a little bit of detail, I'm afraid, because I think they're not really looked at very much, because the changes that have taken place in the division of labour over the last quarter of a century have been so immense that we can't just go back and take the concept off the shelf, that were around in the sociology of the 1930s and 40s and 50s. I think we can apply them to workers doing equivalent things now. We do need to look again at, if you like, the functional sorry. I think firstly, we have to look at the office workers who are contributing directly to commodity production, who are making inputs to the design or the content of products and processes, who are working, selling things, buying things, logistics management, functions connect with distribution, with advertising, with promotion, with marketing. The division of labour within a large manufacturing company now is extremely complex. And it seems to me almost impossible to draw a line and say, these workers are producing surplus value and these are not. They're all contributing through a complex value chain to the production of commodities of one sort or another. Sorry, there are more functions here. You can keep adding them. you can read them for yourself. But my point is there is this enormously complex division of labour within commodity production, and we have to think of those workers as part of these value chains, and critical parts of these value chains. And often the workers with the industrial strength, the workers who can make it possible for a strike to be successful or not in a manufacturing, are often these workers, not the workers on the shop floor. So we've got this whole cluster of functions related to commodity production. We also have another cluster of functions related to the circulation of capital, banking, insurance, communications, etc. There's another bunch of functions that are related to the reproduction of the workforce. Education, health, social services, a whole bunch of things to do with ideological production and reproduction and producing content for mass media and goodness knows what. I mean, I don't want to go into it in detail, but just to point out that large numbers of workers are involved here. In relation to the state, again, you've got a whole load of functions, raising revenue, regulating trade, legal stuff, military stuff, managing the infrastructure. So you have this very large number of different functional roles. And, you know, back in the 1960s, in the sort of political groups I was in those days, we would have sat around nitpicking, saying which of these are producing surplus value and which of them are not producing surplus value. And are these part of the proletariat? Are these not part of the proletariat? You know, with some justice, you have to, I mean, if you're organising a strike, you have to work out who's going to be on your side, who's going to be on management's side. You have to find the fault lines, you know. There are reasons for doing this kind of analysis to some extent. But my point is that the restructuring that's gone on in these functions has been so incredible that it's impossible even to differentiate one task from another, because of the series of things. One of them is the not only the extent of the elaboration of the division of labour, but the speed of the change of that elaboration of the division of labour, so that jobs are in a constant process of being restructured and reskilled. And each time a function is restructured, there's a double process. There's a process by which the tasks of one group of workers are simplified, and you could argue that there's a kind of proletarianization goes on as these tasks are simplified and tailored. But in order for that to happen, another group of workers are required who actually exercise quite complex skills to do with management, to do with retraining, to do with designing the restructuring, to do with managing the offshoring, or whatever it is. So there's a constant double process of upskilling and downskilling going on, with some workers actually being downskilled in some aspects of their work and upskilled in other aspects of their work. But it's a constant dynamic process. That's part of the problem. There has also been a huge spread of generic labour processes with generic skill requirements that cut right across the different sectoral boundaries and the different occupational boundaries. the ability to use Excel, to use Word, or to use a keyboard, or to manage a team. And these increasingly generic skills cut right across the different sectors and the different functions. There is part of the dynamic of restructuring is a modularization of tasks, a simplification of work, which makes workers increasingly interchangeable with each other. The more standardized the task, the easier it is to manage it remotely. And if it can be managed remotely, it can be moved to another location on the other side of the world, possibly, or it can be outsourced. So the restructuring takes place across two dimensions, across a spatial dimension and across a legal dimension of outsourcing. And this outsourcing of activities from one sector to another leads to, on the one hand, a dispersion of activities that used to take place all in one place, but also, on the other hand, new kinds of concentration of activities. It's like Lego bricks, you know, you can build a tower with them, or you can build a long wall with them, or you can reconfigure them in lots of different ways. And these global value chains can be seen as reconfigurations of tasks. Now, the point is, we're going back to that functional analysis I had earlier. If you have, for instance, a local government decide to call centralise their giving of information to the public, and so some of the jobs of local government workers become call centre jobs, then they can be outsourced to a call centre. The work, the scripts that they follow are so standardised. The work no longer has to be done by local government workers. So that can be outsourced. But a bank can also outsource its call centre worker. Or a manufacturing company can outsource its customer services to a call centre. And these global call centre workers have, sitting alongside each other, workers, generic call centre workers, who are working for the public sector, who are working for finance companies, who are working for manufacturing companies, who are working right across the whole spectrum of the economy. Now, how do we then start saying which bits of which tasks of these call centres are adding value to the commodities being produced in the factories, and which bits are part of an arm of the state, and which bits are part of the circulation of capital? Is it even relevant to ask such questions? It's the same with functions like IT support. They're so generic, and they're increasingly carried out by these new global companies that have an internal global division of labour supplying these outsourced services. I think if you want to use examples, companies like Siemens